Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I guess I don't feel like I've actually experienced the South very much, because New Orleans is very, you know, it's its own little bubble.
Dude, it's super South. I mean, it's not South in the way that, like, television will have you think. Like, it's not like, you know, Dallas or whatever. Like, big hair, like, wild, like, also potentially horses. Like, it's not that. But but it's super South.
Oh, yeah.
Like, in its way.
I'm reminded of that randomly when, like, so, like, I took my dog. I have a pug named What-What. And he recently got fitted for a wheelchair. He's getting old. And the person, the, like, rehab vet, which I didn't even know they had those, was like, I was asking him a question about, like, you know, how long should he use it? And when do I know that he's, like, tired or whatever? And the guy was like, well, God made his legs. And so, you know, there's no replacing that. And I was like, ah, yes. Bringing in the Lord into this conversation. I am in the South. Yep.
It's
and
true.
I said, oh, you know, I don't really believe in God. And the look I got was pretty great. But, you know,
I would
whatever.
Be like, you're a doctor.
Like, right.
You, let's talk about what happened when you were in school. Say the Lord is busy. You know, he's got a lot to do. So, just as a for instance, since God provided you with some knowledge, why don't you go ahead and use that?
Right. And also, like, if we're going to play that game, like, then why did God slowly take my pug's feeling out of his legs, you know?
Oh, it's because God didn't invent current dogs. People did. Horrible, horrible people
fault.
Did. Yep. No, yep. Not your fault at all. There was many years, hundreds of years ago, some people were like, you know what would be a great idea? Oh, you're right! Like, they didn't understand the genetic connections they were doing, but they did it.
Oh, no. Whenever I see a wolf, I think about how my little pug, What-What, is somehow related to that. And it's really a fun thought.
It's also wild.
He has no survival instinct whatsoever.
Sure.
So,
I mean, that's what being domesticated does to you.
Yeah.
Ooh, this could go down a terrible political road. Let's talk about theater. My brain just went in this weird spiral of like, oh, we are animals. It's just like we're being domestic. And I was like, nope.
Yep.
Okay. All right, let's dial into. So you live in Minnesota. From what I know about Minneapolis, and I'm going to be honest with you, I only know what they told me in school. There's a lot of theater there.
There's a lot of theater. It's like the number three theater town in the country.
I thought you were going to say like it was the number three like job in the city. That it was like there's steel workers, right? You know, and then there's city employees, and then there's theater employees. That's how Minnesota.
I wish.
Works. Yeah, well, someday. Crazy. Well, no, that would be both silly and ridiculous.
Yeah.
But anyway,
there's a great theater scene there. Stage theater, but also improv. It's really. I was just back there this summer, and I barely recognize anyone from the theater that I performed at regularly. So it's just really growing rapidly.
Did you go back to teach workshops and stuff? Did you like?
Yeah. I
love it.
Last summer, I almost died here because it was so hot in New Orleans. Oh. So I was like, all right, what can I do? And so, yeah, I set up workshops. I did a few drop-in classes. I did a fabulous workshop up in my hometown, all women, and that was really fun and rewarding. But yeah, and then I got to perform with friends too. So it was really, it was very needed. It was a very nice, like, reset of improv for me.
Yeah. Now, yeah. Did you start your improv journey in Minneapolis?
Yeah, I started doing improv in college, so back at, like, 2003, and then I graduated with a stage management degree. Wow. And I worked as a stage manager for the Minnesota Opera for 5 years. And then I realized that I had no life and that I was really jealous of the people on stage. So I, the theater that I pretty much was brought up in, was starting in 2009, they opened. And I started taking, I was like their second classes there. So I went through all the classes there, and then I just started performing regularly, and then I got into comedy sports as well, and then slowly...
Wait, where was the first theater that you said?
Oh, it's called Huge. Huge Theater.
Huge Theater. Oh, okay, sorry. I missed it.
Nope, that's all right. It's it was formed by Jill Bernard and Butch Roy and Nels Lennis. Yeah, and so I slowly, it slowly became my only, my full-time gig. That's all I did, was improv. And then
like,
my husband
like
got...
In a money, like, you got paid
somehow? Yeah, Comedy Sports there, I would get paid. I did a lot of their corporate events. And Huge, actually, if you're on a Friday or Saturday night, they pay you. You know, that it's not, I mostly got my income from comedy sports, but Huge, you know, if you had a 2 month run and it did well, you got a nice chunk of change. And I had an agent there too. So I would sometimes get commercials and, things like that. I taught at Huge as well. So, and they pay their teachers and all that.
Oh, that's
jazz,
good.
So.
Sure.
Yeah.
May I talk to you about stage management a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah, no, I know that sounds like a weird thing for me to be excited about, but it's a weird thing that, like, we have in common. So I thought I would say, hey, wow, I can't believe you did stage management and that you can get a degree in stage management. I did stage management in college. I went to, like, a small school in Dallas. And, you know, we did small plays. So they're really, like, even though I didn't act in a lot of stuff because it was like, well, there's 12 roles and 50 of us.
Yeah.
Could you run the stage management? I was like, sure. And I was into it. I was yeah, what's up? Let's do it. And so I thought when I was going to graduate that I was going to be a stage manager, like for real. And I went to Williamstown Theater Festival summer stock. The summer after my junior year and then the summer after my senior year. So like for 2 summers in a row, I went there and I was a stage manager, like in a professional environment with like legit people and like major plays. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. This is going to happen. Oh yeah, let's do it. What's up? And right before I like graduated, my theater director was like in college, was like, for your senior year, I picked a play that I found an awesome role for you to play in. And I was like, that's so great. So even though I was like gung-ho stage manager, I was in it, doing it, what a career. I still was like brought back into performing in that moment.
Yeah.
Like I legit, like I can tell you where, and I don't, was cell phones even a thing? I don't know, like, it's funny because, what year was it? It was, I graduated college in 2000, so it was the summer of 1999, you know, good year.
So they have just been coming out.
What's up?
Cell phones, I know in, my dad had a car phone.
Right.
So, like, they were slowly coming out.
Right. It's just, I have this image of standing in this particular spot in Williamstown, like after I'd had the conversation with him on the phone. And he sent me, like, he literally, oh, bless his heart. He literally mailed me the mail. Remember the mail? He mailed me the script. He mailed it to me in Massachusetts. Williamstown's in Massachusetts. So I'm like up in Western Massachusetts. He's in Dallas. He calls me, tells me he wants me to act, sends me the script. I was like, oh, I want to be a performer.
Oh, yeah.
He totally hooked me right back in. Totally hooked me back. Yeah. Took me about 3 more years of professional stage managing to, like, accept the fact that that's what I wanted to do. So, like, when you told your story, I was all like, oh, yeah. Oh, I've been there. But yeah. I don't know anything about stage managing for the opera. What's that about? I just did plays.
You know, it's like interesting. So I was an assistant stage manager. So the main stage manager was the one who would, like, you know, he called all the cues and whatever. But there was 2 of us who our jobs were to cue the singers to go on stage for every entrance. So that was during the shows, which you're kind of like, what? That's insane. And, like, yeah, it is insane. But it was the reasoning behind it was, a lot of times professional opera singers will go around the country playing the same role all the time and with different directors. So, like, they can't keep track of when they're supposed to enter. Okay. Yep. So, and then, you know, of course we're also in charge of all the set pieces and the crew and all, you know, just everything. One of us would take costumes. One of us would take props. Yeah, it got to be, you know, there's a lot. I met so many amazing people. And then, you know, there were some singers that were just awful. And, like, I remember one woman was like, she's about to go on stage and she's like, I have gum in my mouth. And I was like, okay. And she grabbed my hand and spit her gum in my hand. Oh. That was, like, I think maybe one of the last seasons I was there, because I was just like,
oh, it, like, I've been there.
You know, you're the first one there. You're the first one out. If something's wrong, it's your fault. Like, it just, like, I really enjoy busy work, and I really enjoy being very organized and you know, connecting all the different pieces together. So that aspect, I really love stage managing, but I didn't love being looked at as the help, which happened a lot.
Yeah. You're like, you know how, like, I'm a major part of this, like, machine. Like, you're right, like, a cog the same way I'm a cog, but we have different functions. Like, don't you understand how things work? Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, the best stage management experiences I've ever had is where people actually understand that everyone's just a different, like, important part of the whole process, as opposed to other times when I've had people who just rip me to shreds. My first summer at Williamstown, I had a woman named Carol. I wish I remembered her last name so I could damn her on the internet now. But she was a terrible, terrible stage manager. But I didn't realize that at the time because this was my first professional gig and the first show of the, like, summer festival. So, like, when you're an intern, you work on 3 shows over the course of the summer. But this was, like, first show, first person that myself and my co-assistant had been assigned to, and she just yelled at us about everything. You know, it was like everything was our fault, and she'd blame us, like, 2 people. Like, they'd be like, hey, we haven't gotten those measurements for the costume department yet, and she'd be like, oh my god, my dumb assistants were supposed to do that and they didn't. And we're like, did she literally say anything to us about doing that? No absolutely not. Like, and so for maybe the first week or so, we were just embarrassed about everything. Like, and legit, okay, I'm going to name drop, and I don't mean to, but this is the first time I've had a chance to talk about this. And, like, I've done 100 and some odd episodes. I've held back this long, but now I have to tell the story. I'm working on it. The play I'm working on is Raisin in the Sun, okay? Huge play. Big deal, right?
Yeah.
And the director that I'm working with is this guy, Jack Hofsis. I'd never heard of him, and I haven't seen him since. He was a man in a wheelchair, but everybody who talked to him like he was the king. So I was like, oh, clearly he's a big deal. Because, like, oh, my God, Jack Hoffsis. And I'd be like, oh, okay. You know, like, context clues about status, right?
Right.
But in this cast was also Viola fucking Davis.
Whoa.
Like, oh, my God. And even though at the time, like, she's, you know, I don't know, in her 20s or whatever, and like, just an actress, you know, out of college or whatever.
Yeah.
She still commanded everyone in that show. There were 100 other people. Like, you know, Raisin in the Sun has got, like, 8 roles, yeah. And every one of the people that was in it was, like, a major person, whatever it was. But Viola Davis was the one that was like, ah! And I was so embarrassed for the first week. Like, what did I do? How am I doing this? And we had like a little meeting with the leader of the interns, you know what I mean? After the first week, and they're like, hey guys, how's it going? What's happening? And we were like, listen, we don't know. Maybe we should quit because she just yells at us about everything. And we don't think that we made the mistakes, but you know, if she said we did, maybe we did. And then they were like, oh my God, we forgot to tell you guys. She is the worst. Yeah, I don't know why we hired her. She is just sort of slipped in, and we'll never hire her again. But yeah, oh, so sorry, guys. Oh, man. Anybody who works with her later, watch out. She's a doozy. And like after that, we were just like, oh, my God. Like it felt so much better that everyone sort of knew right. She was a jackass. Like it was like, oh, yeah. If we're all on the same page about how she's wrong, I'm fine with this. She can yell at me right. all day and I'll just be like, oh, you're right. I'm the worst. You know.
Right. But right. You don't have to take it personally.
But it was so embarrassing because it was like big deal people all around. And I was like, why am I the worst person? I cannot do this professional shit.
You know, I never worked with anyone super famous, but at least not. I mean, actually, there were like some famous opera singers, but like, yeah. I didn't know who the hell they were. So people would be like, oh, my God, that's that person. I'm like, hey, OK, cool. But I did work on the world premiere of Grapes of Wrath. The Minnesota Opera put that on, and it was this amazing 4-hour opera. It was unbelievable. He wrote the lyrics or the words. What is that? The lyricist?
Libretto? Words.
Yeah. So he didn't write the music, but he wrote what they sang. And he was the same position for Great Gardens on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone and seen that and like loved it, absolutely loved it. And so I didn't know it at the time. And then we had our, you know, staff meeting to meet all the talent and everything, and I was like, oh my God. And then I remember thinking to myself, like, keep it cool, Casey, like, don't say anything to him, because he kind of seemed like a jerk, but like, you know, who knows, sometimes people just keep to themselves or whatever. I was like, you guys are equals, you're working on this thing together, like, keep it cool, don't be a fangirl. And I did pretty well until one day I got in the elevator and he got on after me. And for some reason I couldn't stand silence for like one floor. And so I was like, oh, hey, I saw Great Gardens in New York. And it was really great. And he turned to me and he goes, yeah, it was a shit show. And that was it. And
I hate those people. It's like,
I know.
Could you be pleasant about anything?
Talented. No. And so, but he's super talented. So, you know, thing I got sick of with, and I don't know if this is true, not just in opera, I assume, but everywhere. Like what you're saying, like that stage manager is known for being a jerk. Why do people keep hiring her? And it was the same thing with the singers. Like there were singers who were notorious for being jerks. And people be like, oh, well, but their voice is so amazing. And I always just thought, like, it's such bullshit. Like, people who, you have to have common decency. And if you don't, then you shouldn't get hired.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. Yeah, definitely. No, I've known people along the way who, like, were such jerks. And, like, you know, maybe I did curse them. I don't know. All I'm saying is those people are not famous right now, is all I'm saying. There have been some meanies in the past.
Oh.
There have been some wonderful, lovely actors that I've worked with that now they're in movies or now they're in TV or now they're winning awards, whatever it might be. But, like, some of them, no. I don't know where she is.
I'd love to meet someone who works in the theater that doesn't have a story of someone being just unbelievably awful to them.
Yeah.
Especially, like, you know, I always would wait, you know, things would be going great and whatever, and then Tech Week would happen, and then all of a sudden people would just change, and just the stress would just freak them out, and
It's like the difference between taking a weekend workshop and an intensive. It's like, can you really handle the full 5 days of total insanity, or are you going to be fine with, like, maybe a 2.5-er?
Right. Yeah. So I definitely notice that, like, now that I'm more on, I am just totally on the acting side. Like, I remember having my first tech where I was an actor, and I was like, oh my God, this is the easiest thing ever. Like, I can't get over how great it is to not be in charge when it's super stressful and it's crazy. And, like, literally, I just have to either wait to hear my name get called and go and do my scene or whatever they need, or just stand there. You know, and I just, I love it. Just love it.
I'm still a little bit of a control freak myself. So, like, I direct sketch shows, and I really keep it, I hold it tight with my little my little fist with my white knuckles, holding it tight. But
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why I think it's easy for me to produce shows, because I do still have that very much of that control, and, like,
yeah.
I like to make sure that everything is, you know, I like to curate it and make sure it's all nice and whatever. And so, I always have to bite my tongue. It's like, that prop
excuse
is
me.
Missing. And it's like, Casey, that's not your prop. It doesn't matter. Like, keep it cool. Yeah.
I think that the skills that you learn as a stage manager are, like, really good life skills. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, it helps you deal with the, even adulting, even when you're like, I've got to pay this and they're going to yell at me because I haven't paid them in a while. So you can, like, kind of handle it because you're like, meh.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, when you break it down, you're like, well, you know, at times I was like, I'm in charge of a 50 person crew, a 70 person cast, you know, like scene changes, you know, like, it's crazy.
Plus, I love behind the scenes stuff. Like, I love being, I love knowing how a thing works, or like standing and watching the audience while, like, some amazing thing happens, or like, I love working, you know, in one of those big theater houses with, like, a fly rail. And if you stand on the fly rail, you can, like, see both the audience and the performance happening at once. And it's like, this is beautiful. I love this. Like, just seeing the inner sanctum and, like, knowing how something works. I don't know. I really love that. I really do.
Yeah,
I just want
it's
it to
hard
be really
me.
Exciting.
Yeah. It's hard for me to watch shows and not turn my stage manager brain on. And, like, I'm the one who's looking where I shouldn't be looking. And I see how you're doing the thing because you're, like, everyone else is being distracted by whatever that you're supposed to be looking at. So sometimes I can't get lost in the magic of a show.
Yeah, it's hard. I feel that way about comedy, too. I have a hard time with comedy.
Yeah.
Like, not improv, because it's like, you know, the variable of being made up on the spot can change it so drastically that you're like, whoa, what's happening now? But, like, sketch and stuff, or, like, sitcoms, like, I can follow the rhythm and the pattern of it so intensely. There's only a couple of shows that really distract me enough that I can actually watch the show.
Yeah.
Like, I love The Good Place, but the whole time I'm like, look at Ted Danson. My God, that's Ted Danson. Like, the whole time. I can't stop it. I can't be like, suspension of disbelief. This is what's happening. Like, no.
No. Once you know, you know, and you can't turn it off.
So, you went from, so you got your stage management degree, worked a little bit in there, and then found improv. Did like somebody tell you you were funny and so you took a class? Is that how you got into it? Or
no, I did it in college and I really liked it.
Oh, right.
And then my sister was living in New York at the time and was like, hey, there's a theater opening up in Minneapolis and Jill Bernard's running it. And like, you should really like check that out. And then for Christmas, my husband got me classes there. So it just kind of like, I was like, yeah, I had fun with this in college. Like, let me see if I'm still okay at it. And then it really like spiraled. Like it became the thing that I wanted to do all the time. It's the one thing, like, I feel like I can brag about myself. Like, I feel like it's the only thing I can be like, I'm good at that. And have it, say it with confidence. And it's transitioned over the time. When I first started, it was very much like, I like performing and that's what I want to do. And like, come up with like different show ideas and things like that. And then I got asked to start teaching there at Huge. And I did that and I was like, oh, now I'm transitioning more into, I want to spread the joy of improv around. I want to make sure everyone knows about it and can experience it and can use it in their own life to better their life. I mean, I still really love performing too, but I'm finding that my passion is seeing other people start to learn it and experience it and have fun with it. I did a workshop for the Family Justice Center here in New Orleans, which, they are I don't know if they would describe themselves as this. This is how I think of it. It's like a one-stop shop for women and families trying to leave, abusive relationships.
Right.
Physically, sexually, all of that. They have lawyers, they have police officers, they have therapists, they just have all this stuff. And they also provide a lot of art therapy. So like they have yoga and someone comes in and does massages and they have music and drawing. And so I did some improv and the women there were just amazing. Like the simplest little warm-ups or exercises, they took it to a whole new level. And it really brought them some confidence and allowed them to open up. And what was great is we had therapists in the room. So when things did get opened up, I didn't have to try to pretend like I knew how to handle those things. Yeah. So that kind of stuff, I'm feeling very passionate about. Yeah. So we'll see where that goes. And that's the Be Present Play. Is with my friend Taj, who lives in Minneapolis. Our mission is to bring improv as a life tool to different people and organizations. And we were able to, while I was up in Minnesota, do a workshop at the University of Minnesota for some business students. It went really well. And I'm in the works for doing one at Tulane coming up soon.
That's really great.
Yeah.
Have you heard about the Alan Alda Center where he does improv with doctors and scientists and stuff?
Yes, that is. So I want to reach out to him because that my ultimate goal would be to work with doctors in training.
100%. 100%.
Yes, because I'm sure I would love to meet a woman, especially who has not had an experience with a doctor not listening to her. But I think most people can experience that too. And just not listening, not being present, I would just love so much to work with residents and, that's my ultimate. So yes, the stuff he does is just so great.
Am, just mildly obsessed. And like, I listen, I've got his podcast on my queue and like, reading his book and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. I contacted the center to be like, is there an opportunity to take your classes? Like, is there a way yeah. for me to come up and take like a 3-week course or something and be yeah. trained as a person? Because I was like, listen, I don't really want to live in upstate New York. I don't want to be a teacher at Stony Brook College, but maybe someday, but not right now. And, yeah. But I still think that it would be helpful to bring the style of improv, whatever they're doing, to other hubs of medical, innovation. And like Houston is a huge medical place, and like Austin has a lot of really great, medical centers. So I was like, I'm pretty sure there's people around that I could be helping, like mm-hmm. train me how to do it. So I sent them a message, and they were like, we don't have any classes right now that are teaching mm-hmm. people, but if you send us your resume, we'll let you know. But they said, we'll keep you abreast of any other things that are going on. So like they do travel, but they're doing what I was sort of saying, hey, I can do this, which is that
right.
their people are traveling to other cities and doing like summits for doctors and stuff. So yeah. it's like, good. Hey, listen, I'm fine if you guys do it. I just think somebody needs to do it.
Absolutely. Like,
and
absolutely.
I just,
yeah. when you started that story, I really thought you were going to go, well, I know him.
I wish. I wish. Man, this would be a hell yeah. of a name drop episode if I was like, so Alan Alda is my BFF, right? No. Oh my God. No, I watch MASH every day. I don't know. That's as much as I know him.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing is, it's not like, at least for me and what I just heard you say, you don't care if it's you or someone else doing it as long as it's happening. And I 100% agree with that. Like, teaching improv is what I have learned from my experiences is I have no control over what you are going to take away from what I'm teaching you. Mm-hmm. And I kind of love that because I can shout all over what I think is wonderful about improv, what I take from it, what I think is important from it. But that doesn't matter. I don't matter. I'm just this is going to sound real like ding diddle ding dang, but I am a vessel giving you this information and you get to do what you want with it and bring it out into the world.
Yeah. It's essentially yeah. like teaching positivity, and you kind of have to be empty because, metaphor is what I mean,
yeah.
because yeah. your people have to, it's like people in order for them to receive the information from you, they have to look at you and see themselves.
Yes.
Which 100%. Means you can't be like here on the podcast right now, like, I have told so many stories about myself, but this is the format. This is a chatting situation. In improv, yeah. I don't tell them anything about myself. It's not about me.
No. Right.
Like, right. I tell you my name, I tell you why you can trust me, and then I show you you can trust me, and then we talk about you.
Right.
Like, absolutely. Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's really important to be open to that, but just as another side thing, and this is just helpful for teaching, when I teach corporate workshops, at the end of it, mm-hmm. I legitimately, because I don't actually, like literally 90% of every corporate workshop I've ever taught, I don't know at all what their business is. I don't know what they do. I wouldn't know yeah. how to work there. They would not hire me if I was trying to be one of their employees. Because I have yeah. no idea what any jobs are because I've done theater for so long. I don't know if right. that's the same with you because you also did stage management. But I was like, that was my adult job. Like, stage management legit was my, like, my parents feel better because I'm doing an adult job. So that is about as serious as I've ever been. So when I do yeah. these corporate workshops, I have no idea. They could tell me everything about their job and I'd be like, cool. I don't know what that is.
Uh-huh.
So I ask them to tell me at the end what their takeaway was. What part of what I said are they going to take away to their office? And tell me something a little bit about that. Like, it's like, oh, I'm going to talk to my customers differently because X or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I do it because I don't know what they're talking about, but each other do. Right. And they're like, oh, I didn't think of it that way. Tom, that's an excellent idea, you know. And some of them will be like, I think the same thing as you, man. And then that bonds them even more. You know, then the next time they're working on whatever they do, they'll think, Tom gets me. He thinks the way I do. I'm going to ask him for help on this project. And just that little, like, chink in the armor that is the corporate world, if they're able to do that, that's all. That's all I want.
That's great.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Wild.
Absolutely.
So cool. So when you have this business with your friend who's in Minnesota and you're in Louisiana, are you having like, is it like a two-state thing? Like, is it like he's doing stuff up there, you're doing stuff down there, but both under the same umbrella name of a company?
So it's somewhat new, but we... Our, like, pipe dream is that we'll be going all over the country doing this sort of thing. So there's no, we can do it wherever. But
no, register as a business in Delaware.
In Delaware? Okay.
Yeah, there's no taxes.
Oh, great.
Or there's, it's not taxes, but there's, like registering is, it's, like, one of those things that people say they do in, like, spy shows. I know really very little. I'm just messing around. Sorry. You're talking about serious stuff. I'm going weird. Sorry.
I'm going to look into Delaware now.
I'm sorry.
Well, no. It's, so we're both, we meet electronically or, you know, via phone once a week to just touch base and, you know, kind of bounce ideas off of each other of different companies we can reach out to. And then we just kind of came up with a deal where if she gets a workshop up in Minnesota, like, she'll give me a cut because I'll help her design the workshop, and vice versa. So for right now, I'm assuming we're only going to be getting mostly in New Orleans and Minneapolis or Minnesota in general. And yeah, so if there's a chance that one of us can fly to the other place, like, we'll do that. But we're just kind of taking it step by step and, but yeah, so I've been thinking about this for a very long time, wanting to create this improv as a life tool, which is not a new concept, but I was like, I was like, maybe I should be a social worker or something. And then I was like, no, I don't want to go back to school. It's like, why don't I think about what the skills are that I have that I don't need to go into more debt on? And go from there, and it's improv and wanting to help people. So that's where that idea came from. I went back to Minnesota, had coffee with my friend Taj, and she was like, this is what I've been thinking about for a long time too. And so then I was like, well, I don't do well by myself. I get decision paralysis. You know, I get distracted by what, and then nothing happens. So we just decided to partner up, and it's, you know, we've gotten some traction. She's got a couple leads with some hospitals in Minnesota. And then, like, I have Tulane connection going on right now. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I think you're right about, even though you act as if it's a hackneyed idea, this improv is a life tool. I mean, I feel like within the communities, it's a hackneyed idea for sure, where, like, we all know that it's an amazing thing, and so we talk about it in that way. But the rest of the people don't know that. I mean, half the people have to be explained what it is, never mind, like, how it can help you, and then actually feeling the effects of it helping you. Like, that's a, you know, it's a wild situation. And I also was thinking about how, like, in this world, like with so many cultural changes going on in the world right now, and, like, there's just a lot of intensity in the world. And I was like, okay, what can I do to calm people down? What can I do? Or like, what do I hear people saying that they have a hard time with? And can I help them? Like, for instance, we were talking a little while ago, you mentioned like, what person can't say that like a doctor hasn't paid attention to them? I'm going to be honest. I don't know that I've noticed anyone not paying attention. When I say stuff, I'm very direct and in people's faces, and people don't ignore me. And that's just part of my personality. And that part of my personality has saved me from hundreds of problems, from things that I hear from other women where they're like, well, I had this happen. And I was like, why didn't you just tell them to stick it? And they're like, I just did. You know, it's like, for me, that's just my first, like, I'm not like, I just, it's in me. I'm like a little fireball old lady already waving a stick at people going like, you better not, you know, like forever. You know what I mean? So when I hear these women say, oh, I feel this way, I feel that way, I'm like, I don't understand. Or like, that's not how I live my life. And then I was like, okay, I need to figure out a way to teach other women to be like me. Like, to not take bullshit. I'm like, but why would you take any level of bullshit? And they're like, well, because I do. And I'm like, no, no. Like, for me, like, when anyone ever, like, it's just ridiculous. Like, I just laugh in people's faces. Like, any person that's ever tried to, like, mess with me, like, in a way, you know, it's like, where it's like, they're going to harass me for this. Or, like, at a store or whatever, I'm just like, okay, relax. Yeah. How about you do your job and I'll do mine? And if you're not gonna, I can just go. But, or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
I think it's hard for people to be their own advocates. You know, like, for me, my own personal experience with doctors, like, I don't know what's wrong. That's why I'm coming to you. So I'm just trusting everything you're saying and going around in circles. So it's more, at least my experience with it, it wasn't necessarily that they weren't, like, hearing the words I was saying, but they were just jumping to conclusions based on, like, I've never been, like, a super skinny person. I've always, you know, I'm always, if a doctor looks at me, like, they always are like, well, have you thought about losing some weight? As my cure-all for everything.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And that kind of stuff where you're just like, so through many years of having to learn, oh, I have to be my own advocate and I have to like speak up and say, no, I don't think you're listening to me or, you know, and that can be really hard for a lot of, not just women, just people in general to advocate for themselves. And to realize like, no, your experience is valid. And just because this person may be like a quote unquote expert or whatever, doesn't mean that they get to not take in everything that you're saying and make you feel like you're being validated, you're being heard, you're being, you know, respected. Cause yeah, like I'm definitely a very, outspoken person, which is, I think the reason like we got connected in the first place is because of my outspokenness.
Hey man, people who advocate for themselves to get on a podcast, you should. Every person. If you're listening to this and you're like, hey, I do improv, I want to talk, call me. I'm not like weeding people out. I'm interested in human beings. You know what I mean? Yeah, absolutely. You should be advocating for yourself. Yeah, heck yeah.
100%.
That's right.
Yeah. But you know, if you grew up in a, you know, who knows, you know, everyone has their own stories. If you grew up with your opinion never being validated or heard or anything like that, like you may not trust your voice. And that brings it back to improv, where then I want to help you to be able to have that experience of saying whatever word comes to mind and have everyone else say yes to it in a safe, controlled environment.
I didn't connect those ideas when I was saying, but it was like, that's why I was like, I want to show people how they can stand up for themselves, how they can advocate for themselves. You know what I mean? Like, you are important and it matters what you say.
Right.
I think,
and you're
going
to add something that no one else will add. You're going to add something that no one else is going to think of. But even just as simple as making eye contact with people and how powerful that can be. It's just amazing. Like, when you break it down, you know, because, yes, talking with other improvisers, they're like, yeah, I get it. Yes, I know. Yes, and it's so powerful. Yeah, blah. But if you take a moment and step back and really think about the impacts it can have on people's lives, it becomes, like, I just get super nerdy and, like, super giddy about it all. Because it's just so powerful, and it can be translated into any situation.
Not to mention, just to bring back what you were talking about up top, about there being quite a bit of religion in the South. I'm in Texas, so I'm going to bring up God. Which is to say, the world that we live in used to have churches, and people went there to connect with one another, and they were all like, yeah, we all are similar in whatever way, but we don't really have that anymore. I feel like the going to church community thing that used to be around isn't really around. That's not really part of what happens. I mean, even churches, when I hear about churches in town, or like I meet a person and they're like, oh, I'm going to the bazaar at the blank church. Like, people aren't connected the way they were back in the day, where it was like, this is my church, this is my community. And so I always think that, like, that's what you need with improv. Though, to be honest, with all the improv communities that I've been interviewing people from all across the country and the world, the way that these communities are built are very different, each and every one of them. And, like, I like the idea of standing up for myself. I only know my own way. And so I'm like, wait, what? There wasn't just a school for you to take classes at? And then, because of my experience, I, like, assume that's what the experience of other people's was. And the fact that they have to, like, figure stuff out, and they, like, you know, all get together and, like, read the UCB manual and talk about it. Like, I'm like, wow, really? Like, that's what you did? Like, wild. Yeah. You know, so it's really fascinating. And I think you are right that people need improv, that improv is a thing that could improve all of our lives in a way that, like, can give us community, can help us be together, can, like, be something that we stand for in a way. I mean, there have been some rough things that have happened recently that have, like, rocked my idea of having people's back, and how it's like, okay, and even worse, just not to continue to be vague. So I grew up in Boston. Okay. Where the church was legitimately doing some troubling things to people. Yeah. And now in my adult life, my new church, the improv world, has a similar betrayal. I'm like, guys, fucking yes and. The rule is fucking take care of each other. That's the rule. Yeah. Like, come on. And now it's, like, super important to me. Like, when I think about creating something, when I think about your group and the fact that, like, you're trying to help people that are never going to take an improv class, they're just, like, working, you know, they're computer people, or they're people who work in, they're doctors, they're, like, not, this is not a path they're going to follow, but they need to be taught, you take care of each other, we're a group, whatever happens, you got to go with the flow. If it's different than what's in the manual, I don't know what to tell you, keep going. You know, and gosh, I bet you doctors really need to know that.
Oh, God, yes. Yes. 100%. Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, I think it's, you know, it is atrocious that people abuse the beauty of improv and abuse the yes and mentality. Unfortunately, it's happening all over.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I make sure any workshop, any drop-in class, anything that I'm in a position of power teaching, I make sure everyone knows that, yes, the idea is yes and. But you can say no at any time. Saying no when you're uncomfortable is totally okay. And I will stop things if I need to as well. So, you know, I think that's where people get in trouble, is like, that, you know, some people, you know, you hear about horrible things that have happened, you're like, why did people put up with that? And time again, you hear people say, well, I didn't know that I could say no. I didn't know, because I've been taught that we have to say yes and like, even though my insides were curdling and I didn't feel comfortable and I didn't like the character I was given, I knew that if I would have been a bad partner had I said no. And that whole, and that, I'd love to eliminate that whole, like, you know, the, I don't know if this makes sense, but in my mind it does. Like the whole, like, you're going to be cool mentality. Like, are you going to go along with everything? Are you going to be cool? Or are you going to be that person who has a problem with everything? And I would really love to eliminate that you're going to be cool mentality, because no, sometimes I'm not going to be, because if I'm not okay with something, I'm going to speak up and I'm going to say something.
Yeah. I guess it's funny, whenever I hear that, I always think of, like, I mean, it's like old school peer pressure, like after ABC After School specials kind of things. Yeah. I was like, not to bring it back up again, but if anybody taught me to stay away from bullies, it was Jesus Christ and the Latter-day Saints. Those commercials were everywhere. Did you know those commercials?
What?
Do you know those commercials?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, see, I'm never sure if it's, like, local to the area that I was in or everyone did it. There were legit commercials that were, like, 30-second after-school specials. Like, a kid would be like, I'm going to steal this candy bar. And then, like, three dancers dressed in purple would be like, are you sure, Josh? Is that what you want to do? And then they'd do a dance about, like, don't steal. Don't steal. It's not cool. Don't steal. Don't steal. It's not cool. And then, like, they'd disappear and he'd be in the 7-Eleven again holding it, and then they'd be, the owner of the place would be like, hey Josh, what are you doing? And he's like, nothing, I was just looking at this. And then he, like, walks out and they're like, don't steal, it's a bad thing, brought to you by Jesus Christ and the Latter-day Saints. They were making commercials. They were making moral lesson commercials when I was growing up. I grew up in the 80s, and that was
I don't know. I guess it's amazing that I didn't steal and do a bunch of drugs because I didn't see those commercials, but.
Once I found out that drugs were eggs, fried eggs, I didn't eat fried eggs for years. I was concerned about it. I was like, guys, you know what, chickens? Do you know they're drugs? Yeah, I didn't know. Yeah.
I don't know why, but that just reminded me of when I saw the movie It, the original. I didn't want to use the bathroom for, like, a week. So, things are powerful, you know? Things are powerful when you're kids.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in New England, which is, like, Stephen King land. Like, it's weirder there. Yeah. That's why they have to have the extra moral commercials. Because you're like, but maybe I should just murder everyone. And it's like, oh, no, sorry.
No.
Guys. And then some dancers come out and go, don't murder them, don't murder them. That's what happened.
You're like, thanks, Latter-day Saints.
I also, not going to lie, kind of appreciate that they were giving dancers jobs. I don't know, I'm just saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
So many jobs. There's just not a lot of dancing gigs available. My God.
Especially ones with a moral, you know?
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. It's the one thing missing from In Living Color. There was dancing, there was comedy. Where were the moral lessons?
I always asked when I watched it.
Oh, yep. My God. Now we got it with Jim Carrey. She's doing them all now. Oh, man. You know, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to chat with me and sharing everything about your new improv adventure. I hope that Be Present Play goes very well.
Thank you. I hope so too. If you're listening and you're like, hey, my Uncle John could really use this at his lumber company, pass it along.
Oh my God. Improv workshop at a lumber company, it'd be so much fun.
Oh my God. I love the smell of wood. So I would be in heaven.
It'd be so great. Be like eight guys in their 50s wearing flannel, even though you're in Louisiana. Awesome.
Yes. Love a good beard. Yeah.
Oh, man. That's so funny.
But yeah, if I will also just say, like, if anyone's coming to New Orleans, like, feel free to reach out to me. I do a weekly show, and I'm connected with a bunch of people who could also get you on some stage time. So feel free to reach out.
What's the name of the show?
The show is called Haig and Butts Presents A Night of Comedy. So my last name is Haig, and John Butts is the other guy. We have a duo. So that's Haig and Butts Presents A Night of Comedy.
Good.
We have stand-up, we have improv, and it's always pay what you like, and we pay whatever money we make goes directly to the performers. We actually had our show last night and donated all the money we raised to a women's shelter here in New Orleans. We made like $104.
That's great.
Yeah. So it's a good time. And we do a jam at the end that's open to anyone, so even if you're like, oh, I don't have a group or I'm still new, like, still come to the show. You can jam with us after. There's any level is welcome.
That's so great.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you're, like, using this skill that you learned to, like, make the world better. I think there's a lot of dark forces in the world right now, but it sounds like you are a positive force and you're trying to bring joy and pleasant feelings to people, and that's wonderful.
Sure trying. Yep. Yep.
Oh, good. Well, thanks, Casey. I appreciate you being on the podcast.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.